So we are studying Proverbs, and began last week. Verse 7 of chapter 1 is a great theme verse, I think, for the book of Proverbs. The fear of the Lord is the beginning. It's the beginning of wisdom. It's the beginning of everything, actually. The beginning place for all human experiences that God should be feared. And this is a book that gathers a lot of wisdom together in one place. Solomon is credited with not only writing some of this, he gathered other parts, and there are some other authors who were named or collections by other authors. So it's not just Solomon, but because he was the wisest man who ever lived, it makes sense that his name would be attached to this book of biblical wisdom. We mentioned some different characteristics of the book last week. First, that it's not religious, just to review quickly. There's very little about temple worship, sacrifices, prayers, specific religious directions, how to approach God or not. It's about living life. It's the word, the most common word in Hebrew for wisdom is a word that essentially means to be skilled in living life. So it's how God will direct us to live in the ordinary world, not so much time spent specifically in His presence. We mentioned also that one of the assumptions of the book of Proverbs is that right and wrong are hardwired into the universe. The appeal is made to right and wrong, wise and foolish, good and bad. And whether you know anything about the history of Abraham or the laws of Moses or kind of the story of God, you don't have to know a lot about the Bible. You don't have to know anything about the Bible in order to be persuaded, because everybody has some sense. And again, this will be argued against in our world, that says all sorts of any opinion is actually formed out of thin air. Many will argue today, but the assumption behind this book is that we all know what's right and wrong, and that we can be persuaded to think better about it or live better with it, but that the way God made things will be clear if we allow it to be clear. A third characteristic of the book is that it is committed to persuasion, not command. So there are very few thou shalt or thou shalt nots in here. Point is, if you do this, here's what's going to happen. That we are urged to think about a course of action or not and be persuaded by them. And, you know, carrying on from that, a fourth observation is that Proverbs deals not in God's judgment, his active judgment, where he speaks in his own voice as the judge bringing about certain events. I haven't seen you all summer. But it deals with consequences. So you get, you reap what you sow is very much the tone that is followed in this book. So with that in mind, let me build on one other thing we talked about last week, and that is that wisdom is presented in this book in the form of a woman. She is wisdom is her name, but she's clearly a feminine figure. She shows up in chapter 1, she shows up in chapter 8, she shows up in chapter 9, and at various points she is identified to be observed, to be listened to. She cries out in the streets. We have foolishness in the streets. In fact, there's a second woman in chapter 9 of Proverbs, Lady Folly. Lady Wisdom and Lady Foolishness are both these competing figures that have a take on life. And I think one of the things that makes Proverbs interesting is that it's one of the very few places that there's clearly, the persona is female from whom we're learning in the big picture. Now, a father might speak to his son, and there's sort of male voices as well. But behind it all is this lady wisdom who is going to persuade us if we'll listen, as to how to live life skillfully. And I want to ask us to turn to chapter 8, verse 22. We're going to come back to chapter 1 either today or the next time I teach, depending on how far we get today. But I want to sort of reintroduce or more clearly introduce Lady Wisdom, get her in view here before we start looking at some of the specific other texts. So chapter 8 is her voice, as is much of chapter 9. But here's a description. She describes herself beginning in verse 22. Lady Wisdom speaking. The Lord brought me forth as the first of his works. Before his deeds of old, I was appointed from eternity, from the beginning, before the world began. When there were no oceans, I was given birth. When there were no springs abounding with water. Before the mountains were settled in place. Before the hills, I was given birth. Before he made the earth or its fields or any of the dust of the world, I was there when he set the heavens in place, when he marked out the horizon on the face of the deep, when he established the clouds above and fixed securely the foundations of the deep, when he gave the sea its boundary so the waters would not overstep his command, when he marked out the foundations of the earth. Then I was the craftsman at his side. I was filled with delight day after day, always rejoicing in his presence, rejoicing in the whole world, and delighting in mankind. I'm just interested in kind of your first reaction to that. It's quite an astonishing series of statements. Del?
I'm wondering if this is where the world gets its concept of Mother Nature.
Perhaps, although the thing that's striking about this is she antedates all nature. I mean, she... in this speech, is not that she is kind of natural, but and I think it's before the dust, before the water, before the springs, before the mountains, before anything, that God had wisdom guiding him by, you know, his own wisdom, guiding him in the making of things, and it's very ancient. The idea that the world has a shape. And the world, you know, the world is made a certain way for certain things, with kind of wisdom guiding, God's own wisdom guiding him as he made things. It's pretty powerful, I think. Again, because we're, you know, so often taught that the origins of everything are small, and you know, you go from non-complex to more complex, and from amoebas to something else to something else, and there's just sort of a random turning of the wheel, and stuff comes into being for no good reason at all. And how God created is not, we are not being taught the mechanism he used for getting things the way they are, but that they are guided by wisdom is, I think, a very powerful idea. Steve? Oh, he does run. Never mind. I'm sorry, John. I never have said that about you.
So I'm sure it's more than this, but is it encompass in some sense just the physical laws of nature? And one of the problems people that don't believe in God have is, why are the laws the way they are? I mean, where did those come from? And when you think about it, gravity is really a blessing, right? I mean, things would be flying everywhere without some sense of order and control and the reference to the oceans or the water going the right place.
Right. Yeah, that's great. I mean, the physics are fascinating. I'm not a physics guy. I don't understand it, but I'm told that the fine-tuning of the physics of the whole thing is just completely spectacular, if you're willing to see it that way, and that, you know, the precision and the required, you know, that things turn out the way they are is astonishing. So I think on the physical level, but this is beauty language. This is poetry. I mean, springs are springing up, and the mountains are coming into view, and it, even before the dust, she says, I was there. And I just think it's fantastic to imagine God, an aspect of God himself is wisdom, and it's given a figure to think of the world as complex and beautiful and fascinating because God was guided to make it that way. It's very cool. Yeah. Carol? Oh, I'm sorry. Del's not going to turn loose.
No, I won't turn it over until I get time. Anyway, I was just going to mention that Stephen Hawking, who is this well-known physicist who's been in a wheelchair-bound condition for 20, 30-plus years, just written a book, and he's an atheist,
that the world was created by gravity. And, of course, he doesn't explain how you can have gravity before anything was there. But the whole foundation of creation is by the boards. But from his standpoint, the mathematics, if you can explain gravity, which can't really be explained well, it's a whole creation process. Yeah, so,
since Randy's right there, we'll let him go and then Carol.
So the Lord created me at the beginning of his work or his way. Does that suggest that wisdom itself is part of the creation prior to the creation of the physical universe, the first of his acts of old? Well, or is wisdom innate
to God's
character?
Yeah, no, I think it does imply somehow God created something that was allowed to guide him in his creation of everything else on some level. It is God's own wisdom that becomes personified somehow. I mean, this is not adding a fourth person to the Trinity. This is not, you know, but she's a created being of some sort, but that she was guiding the process that things should turn out the way they did. It's and it's poetry, so you can only push it so far. I mean, what technically, you know, which came first, the chicken or the egg? You know, you sort of are arguing about stuff. I'm not sure we can answer completely, but we're supposed to be, I think, taken aback a little bit to think of, you know, this singer of a song sort of guiding God and making things the way they are. Carol?
Well, 1 Corinthians 1:30, it is because of him that you are in Christ Jesus, who has become for us wisdom from God, that is our righteousness, holiness, and redemption.
Great. Great.
So,
what verse is that?
This is 1:30. Yeah, 1 Corinthians 1:30.
First Corinthians.
Yeah, because when I was being counseled many, many years ago here by Bob Smith, mm-hmm. he gave me that verse.
Oh, that's a great
I
verse.
Think he did. Amen. I think he's the one.
Sounds like Bob Smith to me. How about ferns? Do you think that fits in here anywhere, Ellen? Sort of the wisdom of fern creation? Probably does. You never know. Well, let's look particularly at the end of this paragraph. Verse 30. Then I was the craftsman at his side. I was filled with delight day after day, rejoicing always in his presence. So this wisdom personified is part of, let's make a waterfall over here, and let's make some, you know, cool constellation out here, and they're more beautiful all the time, and you find it's not just a mechanical thing. This is wonderful. It's lovely. It's breathtaking. And the more intricate it gets, the fuller it gets, the more amazing it gets. I was beside him like a master workman. I was daily his delight, rejoicing before him always. And then in particular, verse 31, rejoicing in his inhabited world and delighting in the children of man. If you read Genesis, the creation in Genesis, the high point of the creation is the making of the man and the woman. You know, all these other days, you get everything in place, and then on the last day, at the apex, the highest thing, the best thing God ever did was make human beings. More than angels, more than anything else he created, and it's the same thing is reflected in here, that there's so much to rejoice about, but especially I delighted in the children of man, the human beings that God made in his image for himself. One day he will become human. You know, it doesn't say that, but it anticipates it a bit. What do you think? How does that strike you? All of this language of beauty and wonder and dancing and singing and human beings, the greatest thing of all. Just what you hear on the radio every day, isn't it? I mean, this is the perspective you hear on the radio every day. I mean, the news is filled with... No, I'm being completely sarcastic. We have relentless voices saying exactly the opposite of all these things. There's nothing beautiful, and human beings aren't worth a thing. And, you know, why would God care for us?
This whole thing is proof of God.
Okay.
I hear you say Oh, well, it's just short. I just think this whole passage that you read is proof of God. For those people that say, you know, who's God? How do you know the person that's in the jungle, they never get, you know, talked to, or how are they going to accept? And the whole thing is this whole thing.
Yeah.
It just shows the creation, and that's God.
That's great. Do you let the created world sort of sing God's praise to you? We have to give some attention to it. There's a lot of louder noises in the world, but if you let it, the creation will declare, the heavens declare the glory of God.
I mean, observation made, I think, a lot already, but sort of our modern technology really narrows our view. You're looking now at a 4-inch screen, and this is asking us to look up.
Yeah.
And I think we noted on Wednesday at the road crew that so much of modern life, the light at night blocks out your view of the heavens and the ability to see. And I've just been astounded by some of the pictures taken by the Hubble,
yeah,
and beyond. Just unbelievable,
yeah,
photographs of what's out there. And it's just all, I think we are living in this technologically driven society, we're losing the awe and wonder of what's in nature.
Yeah. Nat was going to say something. I'm sorry. Remind me your name.
Janine.
Thank you.
No, I read not too long ago, and I'm pretty sure that this is a quote from Ray Stedman.
Everything is a quote from Ray Stedman. At the end of the day, he said everything.
And he said, the best view of the heavens is at the bottom of a well. Huh. Does that sound like Ray?
Yeah.
But anyhow, I thought that was true.
That's great. That's great. So Nat first, and then...
I think this shows the extreme love of God for the universe, I mean, for what he created and so on. But along with that, I have a question. Why do you suppose he put she on wisdom? I mean, he wouldn't have had to, but does this come along somewhere in the, you know, the male-female type? I mean, that's bringing it down to Earth. I mean...
Yeah. Yeah.
And within our time and our realm.
Yeah. I think it's, I don't have an answer. I think it's supposed to be a bit mysterious, a bit provocative, a bit. But, you know, it says that human beings were made in the image of God, male and female. So God is himself male and female, or there is, you know, he in order for God to express himself in human beings, he needed both men and women. The only way you get it, you know, right, is to have them together. A man and woman together are required to somehow image God as he is. So it shouldn't surprise us that some aspect of God is comfortable being feminine. But more than that, I don't know. It's mysterious to me. Go ahead, Paul.
Yeah. I'll interject a brief explanation of the best image of God is from the bottom of a well. It's well known, no pun intended, that if you're at the bottom of a deep, say, a mine shaft, which is just one example, and you look up, apparently you can see the heavens much more clearly because all the cross rays of the atmosphere are bypassed, are filtered out.
Okay.
So that's just I've never seen that firsthand, but that is a known physical reality.
And presumably it's metaphorical in some regard, too, but I like the physics part, too. So, John?
First, let me invite you to make any correction necessary, especially theological. But I wonder if, in some way, personifying wisdom or describing wisdom as created is an accommodation to our intellectual limitations. And the reason could be, perhaps, and this is where I'm inviting any needed correction because nothing comes to mind for me, wisdom, at least potentially, could be an eternal attribute of God. Mm-hmm. But to communicate it to us, in what most people for eons have seen as an impersonal universe and creation says, it's not impersonal. Everything doesn't just bottom line at the concept of karma, you know, that there's intent behind it and there's care behind it. And the first thought that came to my mind about why being personified as wisdom is it seems it has to be to me recognized back to creation that comparatively speaking, women are more nurturing than men. And I think this may not be the intent behind it, but I think it's consistent with it, is that if wisdom is seen as feminine, it says, this universe works not without care, it works with care. God does care. He is involved, and he's not dispassionate about it. And I think we're much more likely to say, look, relatively speaking, at feminine and masculine and say, we know which side is the dominant one for nurturing. We don't even have to be taught that. We can just observe it and learn it that way.
Good word. Okay, Bob?
Well, to quote scripture, it says in James that the wisdom from above. All right, so if this isn't wisdom, there ain't no wisdom. okay, find it here. I was just looking at it. Okay, but the wisdom from above is first pure, then peaceable, gentle, open. Well, I don't know about the open to reason part. I'm really killing myself there. But full of mercy and good fruits. The main part there that was coming to mind is that it's gentle, yeah. You know, it's... I mean, that's more of a trait of women than men.
That's great.
You know, especially when it comes to counseling, which is what his wisdom is all about, you know. Yeah. Yeah.
There's a nurturing core. I mean, maybe that's John's point, too. Completely antedates creation, let alone the fall. That God is a caregiver, and everything that has come into being is infused with that.
Go. In other words, it's the mother.
Well, this is
because the mother nurtures,
yeah.
And trains and works with the child, and she has to have a lot of wisdom.
We can get busted for talking like this some places, you know, but so far so good. No, yeah, I think this is again completely prior to families that I mean, this isn't. There is no husband. There are no children yet. There's something prior to any of those things existing. But I think we're on to something to realize that the wisest insights will have some merciful, loving, caregiving core to them. And that looking back, that's the way things were made. That is part of, you know, so.
I have a question. Would discernment come under wisdom?
I think so. Yeah, I think so. Picking between two, you know, which is this better or that, discerning a wise counsel? Yeah, I think so. Well, let's move on to chapter one. Lady Wisdom shows up in chapter one, in verse 20. She's shouting in the streets. But going back before that to verse 8, where we left off last time, this is one of the first wisdom discourse in this book, and it's a father speaking to his son, and father and he references the mother as well, but it's the father's voice, and this is a good introduction to kind of, you know, what wisdom is about. A particular issue is at stake. This is a young guy, a young boy. Probably about the age of puberty, you know, he's becoming a man, he's making choices, going forward, how's your life going to go? And one of the big problem, one of the early out-the-door issues in life is peer pressure. How are you going to be who you ought to be given the kinds of influences that are around you? And one of the reasons peer pressure is so powerful is because we don't want to be alone. We want to be independent of what our parents or who went before us. We want to sort of strike out on our own, but we're afraid we don't want to be on our own but not alone. That sort of tension of not having to, and we're not, you know, as a young person, not ready for everything. And so the father is savvy enough to say, okay, I need to tell you about some stuff. Here's how the world works. Here's what you're going to have to face regarding peer pressure. And I think what we ought to assume in this case of this parent or other good parents is, I didn't get this out of a book. You know, I had to walk this path that I'm talking to you about, and I've both failed and had maybe had some successes along the way. I know what it's like to be tempted because I've been tempted. I know what it's like to you know, et cetera, et cetera. If this is a good father, he's giving instruction, good instruction, but he's also acknowledging that I got there the hard way myself, so I have something to offer. That being said, let me read beginning in verse 8 down to 19. Hear, my son, your father's instruction, and forsake not your mother's teaching. For they are a graceful garland for your head and pendants for your neck. Again, this is very attractive language. This young man is likely to want to forsake his father and mother. That's what you do at a certain age. The old folk don't know anything, you know, et cetera. But he's being reminded that these are actually make you a good, you know, an attractive person. They give you what you really want. Now, verse 10. My son, if sinners entice you, do not consent. If they say, come with us, let us lie in wait for blood. Let us ambush the innocent without reason. Like Sheol, let us swallow them alive. Like those who go down to the pit. We shall find... let me go back. Like Sheol, let us swallow them alive and whole, like those who go down to the pit. We shall find all precious goods. We shall fill our houses with plunder. Throw in your lot among us, and we will have one purse. My son, do not walk the way with them. Hold back your foot from their paths, for their feet run to evil. And they make haste to shed blood. For in vain is a net spread in the sight of any bird. But these men lie in wait for their own blood. They set an ambush for their own lives. Such are the ways of everyone who is greedy for unjust gain. It takes away the life of its possessors. Jackie.
This is so like you were saying, there's nothing new under the sun. I mean, look what's going on in the world nowadays. Right. This is how people are getting enticed with all these, I mean, the movies like they were talking about in the first service.
Right.
And all the stuff that's on the internet. It's, I mean, heck. What we should all be doing is reading this to our kids and saying, hey, this is not new what you're going through right now. This was way, way back.
Right. So a gang of young people able to sort of dominate their environment, you know, whether it's gangs in inner cities here, whether it's ISIS recruiters in wherever they're recruiting, whether, you know, you feel vulnerable, you don't know who you are, you're given a pack to run with. And it's not just, hey, we'll go to, you know, the theater and museums. You know, we're going to go out and take advantage of those who can't fight back. We're going to get rich doing it. You know, the sense of, I'm not just a 14-year-old that doesn't know who he is. Now I'm part of something, and we're dominating the world around us. It's very heady stuff.
Yeah, I learned this just this morning on the way here. But I was listening to John MacArthur. And, you know, you've got these, you know, sterling saints of God, towers of virtue. Well, he was actually arrested and put in jail as a child once. He had this friend. You know, he said, you know, I was a good kid. I would never do anything like this on my own. But he says, I had this friend who, I can't remember the first dishonest thing his friend taught him to do. But then he taught him to how he could steal out of the 5 and 10.
Yeah.
You know, and so they went down there to steal stuff, and as they're walking out the door, they got caught by the store detective, and they called the police and threw him in jail.
Learn your lesson early.
I mean, peer pressure is a terrible thing when you're growing up. It's just terrible. It's like you just can't bear the thought. You don't want to do what your friends want you to do, but you just can't bear the thought of being rejected by your friends and being thought a scaredy cat or a sissy or something like that, you know.
And it's not just, this is a father and son, but it's not obviously single gender. I mean, you think of what groups of young girls can do, you know, the kind of vicious junior high, high school age, exclude somebody, destroy them on Facebook, you know, the queen bee of the social circle, and the amount of kind of violence and hurt you can inflict on other people, and you pick on the weak, you think yourself strong because we're the in crowd, we can, you know, bully, you know, a lot of the social media stuff, you know, you post pictures of someone that they'll never ever be able to escape, and it humiliates, you know, people, kids are killing themselves because of kind of social shame that's, and it's all peer related. Nothing new under the sun. Jackie's exactly right. But somebody's got to, you got to tell, you know, you got to help kids say, before you're completely caught in it, let me tell you how this is going to feel to you. How it's going to, and again, I think if we have been either the victimizers or the victims, and we can remember what it was like to be a whipsawed, you know, 15, 16-year-old, help out your kids. I think that's kind of the point.
Steve, I was going to say, when you said hero, son, it struck me that that's the same in the Shema. So hero Israel, you better get, this is really important. So it's almost like they know in the Deuteronomic law, they know the Shema. So he's going, I don't know, this is speculation, but it just struck me as that he would say, hear my son, as an emphasis point. This is really important, yeah. Just like the Shema is very important.
Amen. Here, listen up. Okay, there's some. I think there are three things that are in play here as the gang, the voice of the gang leader is recruiting the new kid. One is that you'll have power. Most young people feel powerless, and they want to feel powerful. And if you join a group, remember, well, what was the West Side Story? You know, the Sharks and the Jets. You know. Dancing around, sort of much, very innocent looking nowadays compared to what gangs, urban gangs are like. But, you know, if you're alone, you're dead. You got to have a crew. And the promise is that you'll be powerful, not powerless. And that's very heady stuff. I think it's heady for older people. It's heady, you know, our company's going to dominate the other company or our whatever it is. You're not a loser. Second thing, I think, is promised is money. Plunder, in particular. Money that we don't have to work for, money we don't have to earn. We'll just take it from those who have it, and we'll, it's the idea that you can be made rich for doing nothing except terrorizing people is, again, kind of attractive. You know, I want the new computer. I want the new stuff. I want the cool clothes. I want the whatever it is as a young. I want, and my family can't afford it, but I'll take it from somebody else. And the last one, go ahead, Bob. You can take the mic. The last one, I think, is the idea of belonging. It says we'll all share one purse. We're all in this together. You know, it's a band of brothers. We're all in. You know, we're on the inside, and you belong. And hard to not be captured by that stuff. Go ahead, Bob.
You know, once you get into the life that Proverbs is mitigating against, counseling against, it's amazing how you can rationalize that you're okay in what you're doing. You know, like there's the old story about Mickey Cohen, who was a gangster in Chicago. I think it was Chicago. He went to a Billy Graham concert, right, and he got converted. And then they figured a couple months later they'd check up on him. So they found out he was still the racketeering and doing everything else. And he says, well, you know, you've got Christian athletes and you've got Christian musicians, and I just thought you could have Christian gangsters. and then there's John Gotti, I guess, when his son got arrested, you know, for being a mobster. And I guess he was kind of ashamed. And his dad, John Gotti, says to him, he says, go in there with your head held up, you know, high and proud. You're not a child molester or something.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's like, okay, I'm not a child molester, but what am I doing? I'm shaking people down, maybe even having some people killed. And I ought to hold my head high because I'm not a child molester, you know. It's just incredible how sin can deceive you, you know, over time.
That's well put.
I was going to say our mind immediately, at least my mind immediately goes to the, you know, an inner city gang or even an ISIS recruiting, but I don't think it's limited to that. You've got sort of a sense that the system is increasingly being rigged, and there's a sense that folks kind of, you know how to make money in any situation. And I think that there's a temptation also as maybe a young man or woman enters business to go in ethically aware. Because you need to be in tune to, I think they've even set up high-speed networks in New York that are nanoseconds faster than other networks. And so they can capitalize on trades ahead of time.
Right.
And this is all sort of a conscious effort to kind of ill-gotten gain, I guess.
Right. Right. And often it happens in stages, so you don't quite realize it until you're pretty far in, that I've compromised a bunch of stuff in order to be. But the pressure is you want to be part of something. You know, you don't want to be by yourself. So, yeah, John?
I was going to say, if you want to see a good movie about peer pressure, look at Good Will Hunting. There is a great where Ben Affleck and Matt Damon, he's a genius, but he keeps going back to the crowd. He could be superior. He could be in a world of his own, but yet he just keeps drawing back because that's where his – comfort zone is. That's where he feels protected.
Right. That's a great point. That's
you know, so.
The only thing about the movie Good Will Hunting that I remember is you got to put up a lot of language that is just blistering.
Oh, yeah. I'm not disagreeing. The language
But if you put up with that, it's the story is kind of is compelling, I think.
Yeah.
Well, I wanted to sort of pull out some proverbs from later in the book that kind of talk about an alternative to the gang. Having friends, there's a lot in Proverbs about what is a friend, a good friend, you know, a healthy friendship. And I think one of the things that characterizes healthy friends as opposed to gang associates is that they're honest with each other. Proverbs 16:28 says, "A perverse man stirs up dissension, and a gossip separates close friends." That a friendship that's valuable and life-giving is one you can trust the person not to gossip about you, basically. They'll keep your counsel. And I've got two or three times in my life that I'm really ashamed of when I was told something in confidence as a pastor, and I knew it was in confidence, and without even realizing it, I'd be somewhere and I'd start telling a story and I'd, you know, this thing would come to mind and I'd forget, you know, the safeguards that ought to have been around it and sort of broke someone's confidence. And but again, I think for the purpose of friendship, the people that you can count on are the only ones you're going to, if they're not going to gossip about you, they're the ones you can open up about and ask for help. And, you know, again, that's life-giving rather than destruction-oriented. Yeah.
This reminded me of George, getting back to confidentialities. I can recall telling him things just assuming that he wouldn't repeat it. And the next thing
he'd
I know,
be smart enough
he's
to know. Yeah. No, that's great, Mary. I think sometimes we make assumptions that we forget to be explicit about. But someone else? John?
A flashback to the peer pressure thing. I don't recall it hitting me as an adolescent, but what comes to my mind immediately was the summer that I think I turned 25, and I had a part-time job and in a warehouse. And everything was going fine until it was for canned soda. And everything was going fine until the wrong cans got in boxes that weren't labeled for them. And I discovered it when I was working the line and realized that everybody else in the crew knew this was happening. And the guy that was our lead person operating the forklift says, "Oh, I'm burying these in the warehouse. Nobody will ever know." And I didn't feel good about that. But I didn't speak up about it either. But by that time, people knew I had completed my first year of seminary, and my supervisor knew that. And he called everybody to account in particular order, and he said to me, asked me, "Did you know about this?" "Yes, I knew about it." And I didn't try to make it happen, but the peer pressure was be quiet about it so none of us get in trouble. And, well, the trouble came. We got found out. Mm-hmm. And he said to me, "Listen, preacher." Mm-hmm. And when he said that, yep. I felt so incredibly ashamed. Yep. As I thought, he could have said anything. I mean, he could have ripped off a blue streak of bad words about me. But to say that and associate that with ethical failure mm-hmm. was devastating. But boy, talk about a lesson learned. That was really powerful. But that pressure, peer pressure, didn't happen until I was 25. Yeah. I usually tried to avoid it.
Yep. I think the church, when the church is a place of gossip or hypocrisy or bullying, or it's one of the main reasons people claim that Christianity is further and further in disrepute is. There are a lot of reasons, but one of them is we're hypocrites at times. And when we are, the Lord takes, his name takes the hit, not us. So, are we a place where the peer influence is positive rather than negative? Or do we bully and gossip and misuse each other just the same way everybody else does? Probably worth asking. Okay, another, in terms of thinking of alternatives to gangs, I think one of the things that characterizes good friendships is that they last over time. They weather storms. Proverbs 17:17 says, "A friend loves at all times, and a brother is born for adversity." The true friend, the true brother, is one who will stick with you when it all comes apart and you don't know where to turn, and they don't just leave you behind on the battlefield. 18:24 says, "A man of many companions may come to ruin." That is, if you want to be liked by everybody, if you're going to try and please every person and join every club and shine in every setting, you'll lose out. But there is a friend who sticks closer than a brother. There are friendships where, they'll survive whatever has to be survived. And that's, again, by God's grace, would he give us people like that to have as our companions rather than the ones who are using and abusing other people? Anybody want to comment on any of that?
Great Ted Williams, baseball player.
John Gotti and Ted Williams. It's a great morning. Yeah. We're kind of covering the waterfront.
So the reporters are gathering around Ted Williams, and they just want smooch up to him, get whatever information. And the first thing out of his mouth is there any Marines in this bar? Because he could relate to them. Yeah. He would talk to them, but he refused to talk to the reporters because he had a camaraderie ship. He understood what that meant.
That's interesting. That's well put. Okay, last observation on this. I think friendships that are worth having, as opposed to those which are not, are ones in which they grow over time. That a lot of us have. I've been getting emails from the La Cañada High School 50th reunion organizing committee, which are going to sort of try and have that happen. 67 when we graduated, so we're a little ways away, but they're organizing. And I realize I had high school friends, most of which I have lost track of and they aren't close friends anymore. But there are some friendships that have kind of stood the test and have, even though they aren't, maybe I'm not physically close to them, people that I know I can count on, they can count on me, people that I care about, people that I I love. And a couple of proverbs to that. One of the famous ones, as iron sharpens iron, so one man sharpens another. There's a sense in which this relationship, over time, turns into something that it wouldn't have been otherwise. It isn't a short-term thing. It isn't a kind of a momentary experience. It's a life sharpening, a life shaping. There's a time quality to it. Well, I think probably that's enough for today. I guess, are you the singing lady again? The music girl?
Singing man.
Okay, so I'm know that we have a chance to sing to end, so that's a good thing. But here's a proposal I have for next week. I don't know if there's another proposal for next week. I can't be here next week. So my proposal is that beginning in chapter 10 of Proverbs, the first nine chapters have these kind of stories in them, where it's sort of like we just read, the father talks to the son and so on. But then beginning in chapter 10, we have the Proverbs of Solomon, and this is a collection that, again, it's attributed to and contributed to by Solomon. But they're almost all just two-sentence deals. The Lord does not let the righteous go hungry, but he thwarts the craving of the wicked. The memory of the righteous will be a blessing, but the name of the wicked will not, and so on. There's just these two-line observations of reality. And so what I was thinking is, if you would be willing to, during the coming week, to read starting at chapter 10 and pick out one or two of these statements, and they're not very often connected to the thing that comes next. They just sort of stand by themselves. But one that makes sense to you, that appeals to you, that you don't like, and you're mad at it, and you want to talk about it, or... but anyway, whatever that, and just have a kind of a body lifetime where everybody comes with a proverb and shares what you think about it and let other people talk about it and use that, because we're not going to get to most of these single observation proverbs. They go on chapter after chapter, and most of them we're not going to get in on. Is that attractive enough to you do something like that during the week? And I don't know who's going to lead next week, but John or Steve or... just a body lifetime. Just let people share and everybody comment and sing at the end.
So remember that then. Read through and pick out, remember the ant, O sluggard, or whichever one you really connect.
Remember the ant, O sluggard. Everybody may have that one. Who knows?
That's the one that comes to my mind. Father, I'm so thankful we can close with that prayer. To you, thank you for such a wonderful hymn to follow our time in your word. And I pray you'd impress on our minds and hearts now to be reading the Proverbs for next week, that we might share our time together. And I know, Lord, when we do, we're truly blessed. There's so many wonderful saints in this room. And so go before us for next week and prepare our way. Thank you again. In Jesus' name, amen.